Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome everybody to CMC Radio. I'm your host Rob May, and it's Wednesday morning at 10:30 a.m. here on the East Coast, and very excited to have back on the show today with me Dr. Mark Rasik out of Farmington Hills, Michigan. Dr. Rasik, how you doing this morning? Dr. Rasik, are you there?
Okay. How about
hey,
now?
Dr. Rasik? All
yes.
Right. Perfect. All right. Great. Well, welcome back to the show, Dr. Rasik. How are you?
Thank you. Sorry about that little technical difficulty.
No problem. How's everything been going over the last couple of weeks?
Busy, but good.
Good to hear. Okay. So, Dr. Rasik, this is part four of the extended series that we've been doing with you guys now. And, you know, obviously, like I said, over the course of the first couple of episodes, we've learned a ton about, you know, kind of, you know, what not to do, what to do, you know, and really just the facts and how health, the idea and the perceptions of healthy living have really changed. But before we move on to today's topics, and again, I want to make sure that we reiterate all of the healthiest options that there are and the misconceptions that people probably have out there. I want to cover that. But before we get into all of that, why don't you share with us a little bit about yourself, your background, and you know, how you got to where you are today?
Well, I finished med school in 1988. I went to med school out in Iowa. I've always wanted to be a doctor. My dad was a physician, and I watched him grow up and used to follow him around, even when I was a little bit into some of the house calls he used to make and worked in his clinic.
Right.
And then I eventually came back home to do some medicine. I was going to do family treatment, just like my dad. My dad kind of sensed that I needed probably something a little more than that. So I went into cardiology, and I do general cardiology. I do some interventional cardiology with angioplasties and stenting and the emergency heart attack patients. And by the same token, I still never left my general medicine sort of roots, and so I do a fair amount of general medicine as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you do general cardiology. So what does that mean as far as, you know, what it is that you are actually capable of doing, and how in-depth does some cardiology get?
Yeah, well, you know, cardiology is one of the reasons I went into cardiology is because it really does have all aspects of medicine. I mean, there's certain cardiologists that go into preventative care, which would be, you know, pressure, lipid clinics, those type of things. There's cardiologists that do echoes and ultrasounds, and they're called non-invasive or imaging physicians. And they do all sorts of specialized, they read the nuclear scans. There's the interventional cardiologists that do the implantation of stents, balloon pumps, support devices. And then there's the electrophysiology guys that put in the pacemakers and the defibrillators. And then the general cardiology guys do a little bit of everything, but don't necessarily subspecialize. So if they needed something to be angioplastied or something like needed a pacemaker or a defibrillator, they would send them to the subspecialist that does those.
Sure. Now, are you happier with your decision in sticking with the general cardiology as opposed to being a subspecialist?
Well, actually, I do. I'm triple board certified, so I'm internal medicine certified, I'm general cardiology certified, and I also do the angioplasty, so I'm interventional cardiology certified. So I actually do all three.
Wow. Okay, so one was not enough for you.
Yeah, I tend to have a little bit of problem focusing, but it worked out well.
Very good. And you know, and I do want to reiterate too that you know, the things that I've learned about you over the course of the first three episodes was really that you do go above and beyond for your patients. You know, making yourself available, you know, via cell phone, and you know, I know that that's something that probably a lot of doctors out there, you know, aren't doing. I know for myself, my doctor surely isn't doing that. So,
yeah, my dad was a big proponent. If you're going to be a doctor, you should be available. So, in those days, you called the house, and I
right.
remember my dad being there for his patients, and I wanted to be there for my patients as well. So they have access to my cell phone, my email, and even my home if they wanted.
Absolutely. And so moving on with today's topics, Dr. Asik, a big thing that I've been reading about of late is how oral health and how they're finding these correlations between, you know, a bad, not taken care of well mouth can relate to the heart. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, you know, there's a lot of things in cardiology that are associated with heart disease or vascular disease in general and events. The problem is connecting those into a cause and effect. So in the day when we were looking at patient populations and say, vitamins, there was a strong correlation from population data that taking certain vitamins reduced heart attacks, strokes, and death. Well,
right.
You know, there's an association with maybe having low levels of those and treating them, but it turned out that much of that data may be that if you have somebody who worries about their health and they take vitamins, they also tend to exercise, eat better. Those that have better oral and dental hygiene takes care of the rest of their bodies better. So it may be just simply we're finding a patient population that actually is taking better care of themselves, and it only makes sense. We've taken patients that had certain bacteria. We thought those bacteria may be part of the plaque rupture process. They were treated
sure.
with antibiotics. Nothing changed. We gave people thiamine. We gave them B12. We gave them folic acid. We corrected some of the abnormalities. Nothing changed. We got patients that we said, okay, we got inflammation. That didn't help. So the problem is that, well, yes, a low vitamin D level may be associated with heart attacks, strokes, and death. We don't have any data that says replacing it makes it go away. We know depressed patients tend to have more cardiovascular events, strokes, and heart attacks, but antidepressants haven't made that go away. So there is an association with gingivitis and cardiovascular disease, but I'm not sure we really have hard data that says if you floss and take care of your teeth and do nothing else, that should take care of your cardiac issues.
Right. So a clean mouth, the person with the cleanest mouth in the world that flosses every day, but that doesn't exercise at all, is still at risk.
Exactly. I mean, we know associations, and that's the best we can do. And then when anything's correctable, we should correct it. And the association is there. It's not insignificant, but we don't seem to be, when we look at the patients and we look at everybody with their risk factors, there's still a good 15 to 20% of those patients that have absolutely no risk factors. They're still having heart attacks. So there's something there that we're missing, and we keep searching for it.
Right. And so it's not like you've ever seen a patient with, you know, bad teeth or anything like that and said to them, you know, what else are you doing? You know, does it make you think? Did it ever cross your mind to ask them about that? Like if they were suffering from a certain thing with the heart and you saw them smile or something like that, did that kind of ever stand out to you, or that's just not even an issue for you?
No. I mean, I definitely document it. And then once you see the teeth in disrepair, you certainly find that sometimes they're disrepair because they're smokers. A lot of coffee, they dehydrated because they don't do the water. You know, usually you start beginning to pick up that there's other items that are being neglected.
Right. Sure. And that brings me to my next question. You know, in terms of smoking, as you just mentioned, with all of the warnings, obviously, I mean, people know it kills, it causes cancer, it causes 100 different things, and if not even more. But can the effects of smoking actually be diminished once a person actually were to quit?
Yes. And to be honest, it's never too late. There is damage that can be permanent. But the rationale that I've already done damage to my lungs or I've done damage to my heart, so there's no use quitting, is a fallacy, because now it's probably even more important because you've got reserves that are diminished. And if you keep
right.
smoking, obviously you're going to lose those. But typically, for the lungs and the heart, you know, 7 years it seems to be the magic number that you would then revert back to. If you haven't done permanent scar or damage, if you stop smoking and 7 years later they were retesting you, you would test mm-hmm. as if you never smoked. So it does take a while for the effects, but it you know, that's for perfect. Now, each year, you gain back. You know, function, you gain back. It's amazing to show regression in some of the disease in the lungs and in the different parts of the body. So patients need to know that it's never too late to quit. And even if they've got damage, you know, what little reserve they're living off of is at jeopardy. So it's a powerful predictor of death.
Wow. And now you've seen that, though, where people have actually quit, and over the course of the years, of 7 years that you mentioned, you say that it looks like the exact replica of someone that never smoked?
Oh, yeah.
Wow. That's really incredible.
Once they put in, you know, we usually calculate things out sort of in pack years,
mm-hmm.
How many packs a day for how many years.
Sure.
When somebody has a total of a 10-pack year history, one pack for 10 years per day or two packs a day for 5 years, you know, you tend to start doing some damage. Some of it's permanent.
Sure.
And it's called emphysema. And so the longer that goes on, the area that's damaged may not come back, but the other areas that are starting to get into trouble can reverse. It just, there's going to always, like anything else, be a point of no return. And, of course, it doesn't even count the malignancies and other issues.
Sure, absolutely. And now, with regard to alcohol, again, another legal substance that people certainly abuse. You know, it's advertisements are everywhere. It's just there. It's not something that people are going to really stop doing at this point. But as far as that goes with cardiovascular disease, you know, is this another thing that can be reversed? The effects of heavy drinking or moderate drinking. I mean, I know that everything's in moderation, right? We're still going by that thing, correct?
Okay. Right. So, right. You know, the positive effects, and you probably aren't hearing a whole lot of it lately because, you know, everyone had different sort of theories why the alcohol may be beneficial. And one of them was the antioxidants and the red grapes in particular. But the problem is that when people were given oral doses of those high-dose antioxidants, they didn't really seem to get a benefit. Then it was grape juice has a lot of antioxidants, but then grape juice didn't show the same thing as wine. Now it does affect the platelets and can thin the blood a bit. So then the theory was if someone drinks 1 to 2 alcoholic beverages, a normal serving size, and they were to do it every day consistently, then that may be beneficial. The problem was that some people wouldn't drink 7 drinks a week or 14 drinks a week. They would drink 1 on a Monday and 13 on a Friday. So then the theory was, well, too much is causing over damage. One a day, not enough. And then there's the withdrawal effect. So overall, you know, if the patients are going to drink, I tell them they can have 1 to 2 small or normal-sized drinks. If they exceed that once they start drinking 1 or 2 drinks, they can't stop from drinking 8 glasses, then they shouldn't drink at all. Once damage is done to the heart, alcohol tends to cause what's called a cardiomyopathy, a weak heart, and it affects the pumping function. It's a toxin to the heart at high levels. So those are patients that don't have any blockages in their arteries normally, but their heart muscle is very weak, and so the pumping doesn't work well and can get into trouble with heart failure and arrhythmias. So those guys, if they stop drinking, they go cold turkey, usually I'd say maybe half the time, 3 months to 6 months later, they can recover their function. Those that don't are unlikely to, and if they're 6 to 9 months out after that, the initial diagnosis, then those are the patients that ultimately need that defibrillator, and of course they're told they can't drink. It's just you got very little muscle left, and obviously it's a toxin.
So on the comparison of what's really worse for people, you know, do you typically think smoking or alcohol would be?
Smoking is you know, if you the average person smokes 1/2 to a pack a day, the damage from that is far worse than someone who might be drinking 3 or 4 drinks a day. Over time, they both take their toll, but clearly the cigarettes are hands down the worst.
Crazy. It's you know, that's just crazy to me how cigarettes actually made their way into you know, pop culture, and it's just an accepted thing, and you know, for all those years that people thought nothing of it, you know, having pregnant women still being able to smoke, and I mean, crazy.
Oh, I know the doctors ate ashtrays at the stations. I mean, they were smoking in the hospital.
Wild. That is
really
wild.
And you know, the other thing too is that it's not being really mentioned out there a whole lot. Is smoking marijuana. I mean, it's the same concept,
right?
And if nothing else, maybe even worse because there's no filters, and so anything inhaled into the body. Is, unless it's oxygen, should probably not be inhaled, whether it's the electronic cigarettes or whether it's marijuana. These are foreign particles. It causes inflammation, and it damages the lungs.
Now, do you have people come in that say, listen, Doc, I don't smoke cigarettes. I do smoke weed, though, for
sure.
Particular purposes.
Right.
And
in fact,
you know,
I ask it all the time. There was a time where I would only ask it if I thought it made sense. But with medical marijuana becoming very popular, I it's every patient I said, do you smoke? They'll say no. I said, do you smoke anything? Do you smoke marijuana?
Right.
Do you have the e-cigarette? And do you do the hookahs? Anything. And then sometimes that'll come out. But the popular belief that you know, marijuana has never been proven to hurt the body, they're mixing up their data. And
right.
The fact is, marijuana does cause bad emphysema, bad pulmonary disease. We're going to have a whole generation of some pretty sick lungers coming up.
I think, I think just the general outlook of, well, it's not tobacco, and it's, they say, of course, that it's more natural, obviously, than what's added into tobacco, but, I mean, is there any truth to that, do you think? I mean, the stuff that's now legal.
Well, it's, you know, the tobacco, for what help it does have, is filtered. And the tobacco, you know, as some sort of FDA oversight. The truth of the matter is they both are awful. The
right.
Marijuana is unfiltered. You hold it in your lungs far longer than you normally
right.
would, and it's that contact time between the debris in the lungs and is much longer than it would be for a cigarette. So, you know, I've got friends that were smoking clove cigarettes.
Sure.
It doesn't make a difference what you're smoking. You're inhaling. You wouldn't put your head in your fireplace and inhale all that ash. So if they want medical marijuana.
You really hope not.
Right. If they want medical marijuana, I eat it in a sugar-free, fat-free brownie. I don't disagree that maybe the data on marijuana as a chemical, not being deleterious, I don't know if we have that. But certainly inhaling anything other than oxygen, we show very strong data. But they don't want to eat it because they don't get the instant gratification.
Sure. But, I mean, as far as that goes then with the medical marijuana side of things, so would you recommend, because I'm sure they do have the edible form available to people, wouldn't you say then that they could just simply do that? Because that will be, at least on the cutting out the smoking side of things, better for the person.
Absolutely, and I tell them that all the time. I said I don't have the data or any problem with marijuana as a chemical, as an agent.
Uh-huh.
The delivery system I have a problem with, but
sure,
that problem is it doesn't give you that gratification, and you always have to make sure that they're actually taking it for medical reasons. When
right.
someone's having lung problems and they can't breathe, and they're using joints and smoking marijuana to help with that. Something that doesn't make sense.
No, yeah, you would think that somebody would stop them. that doesn't work. But now, in terms of the best activities to kind of reverse the effects of alcohol, tobacco, drug use, you know, are there specific things that you know about that you would recommend to people, you know, to help speed up the process?
You know, the alcohol related heart disease, the cardiomyopathy. You know, certainly it's we are not sure why some of those patients recover. Maybe it's a total of the total amount date or the duration. But, you know, we control all the risk factors that we can. We try to avoid sodium overload. They can't really be on anything that would be toxic to the heart. Anybody with a weak heart shouldn't be on stimulants like pseudoephedrine or some of the over-the-counter medications or health aids. I get a lot of patients wanting to take something that's going to give them energy, help them lose weight, maybe get their memory going. All those agents are stimulants and are bad for the heart. So those patients just abstaining and maintaining, you know, reasonable activities. not so much lifting because, you know, heavy items for the cardiomyopathy patients are a problem. The heart's already struggling. So I tell them to, you know, do aerobic activity, not to lift any more than 10, 25 pounds, somewhere in that range. And the other patients, if their heart function's okay, exercise is huge. Swimming is probably one of the best ones out there, but aerobic activities is the key to living longer and to improving your cardiovascular health.
All right, so everybody better pay attention to that one because, you know, sitting on the couch is not going to help you.
Exactly right.
So, I mean, so really, this is actually leading up to my next question, which was how does weight affect the heart? And, I mean, it sounds pretty obvious, but I've got to be honest with you. I have seen, you know, people that looked overweight or, you know, that looked unhealthy that would, you know, tell me, oh, no, actually, my heart health is actually somehow great, they said, and da-da-da-da-da. I mean, does the weight have that much to do with your heart health? And what is considered overweight at this point?
Well, so the truth of the matter is there is no healthy obese patient. And while that is something that they clearly, you know, we as a society, okay, everyone wants them to feel good about themselves, and we don't want anybody
right.
thinking that we're picking on anybody that's obese just because they're not appealing to the eye.
But sure.
The data is clear. The heavier you are, the more medical problems you will have, and the shorter your lifespan. Medical obesity is a body mass index of over 30. And so we know that not only is it considered a disease now, it took the AMA way too long to come out and officially say that. So there really isn't a version of I'm obese but I'm healthy. And then on the same token, people who lose weight, those bariatric surgery patients, there's a lot of data when they lost weight, they lived longer, their comorbidities dropped. So being obese is a medical problem, and the people that say, but I'm healthy otherwise, so I'm going to be fine, it's probably more rationalization than it is evidence.
Sure. Absolutely. And with, obviously, the convenience factor of such things as fast food, in your experience, you know, why is it so bad and how bad is it for people to be eating fast food?
Yeah, see, the big problem with fast food is yes, well, the convenience, the ease, it's full of very addictive products, the sodium, the fat. I'm sure we've all seen the movie about Super Size Me. And
yes.
And the gentleman, you know, began to overload his liver with fats, and it causes blood pressures to go high.
Mm-hmm.
The body's constantly craving more fats and more sugars and more simple carbs. It's almost a drug-like effect, and then it causes the obesity, which then causes sedentary life styles, and then insulin resistance. I mean, the effects are well known, well drawn out. And it is the problem is it's cheap, it's easy to get at, and it appeals to a large population, either those really busy or those that don't have money. I mean, you can get a bucket of fried chicken for less than what a couple of heads of lettuce and some vegetables are, and those go as bad in 2 days. So the problem is that the healthier food is, you know, it's harder to get, cheap, it's more expensive. You have to actually put it together most of the time. And,
yep.
And it's got a limited lifespan. So, you know, I understand why the patients are doing this, but there's a reason why they've been mandated to put their nutritional information out there in front of the counters, not that we're reading it, but it's out there so that everyone knows, like the cigarettes, you know, you're doing this. If you do it excessively, these are the problems you run into.
Sure. Now, healthy eating. I'm curious, but before I ask you this one question, I'm curious to know, what is your daily intake like? What's your meals like?
Well, you know, the key is, you know, depending on your activity level,
mm-hmm.
and no one likes to hear it oversimplified, and I know there's more to it than that, but the first premise is basically if you're taking in more calories than you're burning off, you're going to get a net excess.
Mm-hmm.
If you take in more calories than you need, then it gets stored, and it gets stored into adipose tissue or fat. And then you begin to gain the weight, and the cycle begins as we spoke. So the idea is not to starve yourself, because then I get my patients saying, well, I only eat one meal a day. And that then sends a signal to the body that it's in a stressful situation, perhaps out somewhere where you can't get food, and natural evolutionary response to the body is, I need to shut down the metabolism because we're under stress. We need to hold on to these calories. We may need them for a long winter or something.
Mm-hmm.
So starving yourself doesn't work. Eating foods in excess is going to get us into trouble. And then if we get down to a reasonable amount of food and we're eating it on a 3 times a day or 3 to 5 times a day type of thing to keep the metabolism cooking, now it's a matter of what do we eat. And of course, there's the old food pyramid, and there are all the numbers. But the bottom line is that, you know, the body tends to take in what it needs. We tend to eat above and beyond it. So you eat till you're full.
Right.
You got to get your fruits. You got to get your vegetables. If you're going to eat carbohydrates, you need complex carbohydrates, not simple ones. You need whole grain. You need to eat, if you're going to eat fruit, you're going to need apples and pears, something with fiber in it. It makes you feel full. It takes a while to break down. When you eat simple sugars, simple carbs, like the white rice, the white pasta, that gets broken down very quickly into sugars and triglycerides. And when those drop, the body says it's time to take in more. And it feeds in to that cycle. So it's lean meats, you know, not the fatty ones. You want to avoid breading things, putting egg and breadcrumbs on it as opposed to just making it. You want to grill, you want to broil, you want to bake. Deep frying, chicken fried, that type of stuff is not a good idea. It sounds very intuitive and it sounds like it makes sense, but until it's put out in front of you, and I think that's why some of these Fitbits and some of these other things, at least initially to calculate out how much you're taking in, And it really is an eye-opener to the patients.
Right.
Because I don't think they realize what they think they take and what they are taking in match up. And when they see that discrepancy, I think that's that aha moment for them.
Sure. And Dr. Rasik, while we are winding down to the last 2 minutes of the show, I do have a big question for you because it has come up recently too. Red meat, processed meats. Do you believe that it causes cancer? Is it that bad for you?
You know what, I don't think, I mean, that's been going on since I was a med student. And that time they were saying grilling was bad because the nitrosamines from the grilling. And again, moderation's everything. Red meat's okay. It shouldn't be raw. It should be fairly well cooked. And it needs to be on a surface that, you know, drains off the fat. And it should be a lean cut of meat. And I think you're fine with eating meat.
Sure. But what about as far as, like, sausages and stuff like that, tubed meats, hot dogs? I mean, is that
those tend to be very fatty. Whether you believe the nitrosamines and stuff like that causes cancer, I mean, I can't believe someone would eat enough hot dogs in a lifetime to create cancer. We have a lot of other obvious causes, including the sun and background radioactive type of issues. The last thing I would think would show up on the radar is eating too many hot dogs. It's just not good for you from the sodium or the fat standpoint.
Right. But you think people are more, they're in a little more trouble if they're smoking cigarettes as opposed to just eating hot dogs.
Oh, yeah. If they're eating a bunch of sausage and hot dogs, they're going to die from a heart attack and stroke probably before they get a cancer from it. I think they're looking, they're right neighborhood, wrong house.
Sure. Well, Dr. Rasik, unfortunately, we are running out of time today. I do want to thank you for coming on to the show and doing the series with me. Again, very informative stuff, and I had a blast working on it with you. Hope to have you back soon to get an update about things and see how everything's going with you. So why don't you let everybody know real quick, you know, where the best ways to really contact you if they have any questions or anything like that.
Sure. Well, my practice is in southeastern Michigan, and it's Farmington Hills, Michigan. And probably the best way to get a hold of me is through my email at mrasik, R-A-S-A-K, at heartdoctors, and that's heartdrs.com.
Well, thank you again, Dr. Rasik. I really do appreciate you coming on.
Well, thank you. It's enjoyable.
All right. Thank you again. Okay, so from everybody here at CMC Radio, this is Rob May saying we'll see you soon. Take care, everybody.